Mr. Connor is a registered representative and managing principal with Connor Wealth Management. Securities offered through Commonwealth Financial Network, member FINRA, SIPC. Opinions expressed on this show are strictly those of the host, its guests, and callers, and not those of WLVL, its management, staff, or sponsors. Nothing contained in this program should be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell a security, and if applicable, only after the prospectus has been read and understood by the customer. These decisions can only be made after consideration of an investor's investment objective and the investment suitability.
All right. Good morning, folks. It is Friday, June 17th, and I am joined in studio by Mr. Eric Connor from Connor Wealth Management. Good morning, Eric. How's things this morning?
Good morning. It's bright and sunny, so we'll take that as a win right now.
Absolutely. It's a gorgeous day. Good day to have a good day. That's what I'm thinking.
There you go.
Right on. So, what's going on? Tell me about yourself. How's your life? Let's break into this nice and easy here.
Yeah, we've had a lot of news happening in the last couple of weeks. We've had more inflation news, more interest rate news. Clearly, the market has not been digesting it in a good way. You might say the market's suffering from indigestion, I guess.
Needs some Pepto-Bismol.
Yeah. Needs a summer vacation.
Doesn't it, though?
We're not even officially in summer, and the market needs a vacation. Yeah. The one thing I wanted to sort of mention for people that are sort of seeing the erratic nature, I want to sort of take a minute and just sort of explain where some of that comes from. So towards the end of May, early June, we started to have a few data points that were pointing towards a lessening rate of inflation. And that simply means that the pace of inflation was moderating a little bit. And so with those data points, the market had started to find a little bit of a bottom, had started to come up a little bit. And then we got to last Friday and some data points came out that were not beneficial on the inflation view, and they were quite strong in terms of the rate of calculated inflation. And so you saw last Friday a pretty good decline in the market, and then we had the weekend, and then come Monday you had a pretty good decline in the market. And that's a jolt that happens because of the change in expectations that suddenly come in when that inflation number came in last Friday. And so that takes us in within the story of the week. That takes us to Wednesday, where the Federal Reserve makes an announcement of a 0.75% interest rate increase, where the expectation that they had laid out was that they were going to do 50 basis points. Kind of like a stair step, 50 basis points, then the next meeting, 50 basis points, then the next meeting, 50 basis points. Well, let me just sort of throw out there that that data point that came out last Friday was so jolting to them that I think that's what made them move to the 75 basis points. But here's the thing, right? The market keeps digesting the points of information that come out and the Federal Reserve's moves. And even after them moving the interest rate higher in March, and then whenever the next meeting was, which I think math-wise was the very early part of May, and now in June, you only have the interest rate that the Federal Reserve works on is the short-term end of the curve. They don't set the 30-year or 20-year or 10-year rate. So at the short end of the curve, they're still below 2% in terms of their current interest rate. And if we've got inflation running at 6 or 7 or 8%, and the last calculated number from last week was, I think, 8.6%, They are still well behind the curve, and that's where you're seeing the market correct, even though we've got a strong enough economy right now. The jobs market is still really, really healthy. The market is correcting now in anticipation of the Fed continuing to move those rates higher to combat inflation. And there's starting to be more and more of a belief that the Fed is far enough behind the curve on inflation that they're going to stumble their way into creating a recession with their interest rate increases as time goes on. And that might be that it's 6 months from now or 9 months from now or a year from now. There's a pretty good lag time behind between when they've raised rates, you know, in air quotes, too much, and by the time you actually tip yourself into a recession. So that's what's got the market a little bit upset here. Now, I try to make the point to people all the time that just having a raise in interest rates does not mean we're going to a recession, right? There is not a correlation of just because we have higher rates, it does not mean we create a recession. It also does not mean that we have to have a big problem in the stock market itself. But in the scenario we've got right now, the market is concerned about the rate of inflation, the rate of increase in interest rates, and they know that when you have higher rates, you get a tighter, you have a PE compression, a price to earnings ratio compression happens in the market. So what it means is as rates go up, the valuation in the market gets a little stricter, right? If someone was willing to pay 25 times earnings for a company when we had rock bottom interest rates, if interest rates go up a bunch, which we're seeing them starting to climb, you're not going to continue to pay 25 times earnings. It'll decrease. It'll go down to 20 times earnings. And if you go from 25 times earnings to 20 times earnings, can't trick me, that's a 20% correction. And that's the sort of thing we're seeing in the market. We have decent enough earnings in and of itself, but the market is constantly eating this buffet of information, and part of it is just coming out with it equals lower prices right now. And so that's a whole lot of – that's like I think I timed myself on the little computer clock here, about 5 minutes of me trying to explain – the market is digesting a lot of information. And yes, we've still got a good jobs market. And yes, we have decent earnings in large parts of the economy. But the market is telling us that they have that it has a concern about the Fed sort of missing the boat in what they're doing. And so, again, if they've still, even after this 0.75 percentage point increase in interest rates, they're still below 2%. If the inflation number is running at 8, that tells you they are going to continue to raise rates higher. And the market overall is sort of saying, we're not loving the chances of not screwing that up and putting us into a recession and creating weaker earnings in the future. And so you've got a scenario here in the last, it'd be convenient to just say 2 weeks because it was 2 weeks ago that I was here on the radio, but it's probably now running more like 3 and 4 weeks. Where almost across the board, you've got a general weakness in the market. You don't really have a pocket of space where something, some area is up. And that even includes right now the oil companies, right? You'd think where gas and oil are, you'd think they would just still be booming higher. And over the last couple of weeks, that is not true. There might be some individual choices in there. I'm just talking broad sector. Even they have shown some weakness. The commodity stocks, which should be responding to the inflation rate, they are not showing any kind of gains right now. Oil is even off. I think the Fox News headline at 10 o'clock was saying it was off $3 a barrel. Gold is not at a high because the dollar is strong. Copper has come off its highs because there's an assumption that the housing market, new build in the housing market will weaken. So you've got vast areas of the commodity industry that you would think with inflation would be looking really strong on a stock perspective, they are not, right? They are 20% off their say, year-to-date highs, or 25% off. The agricultural side should, in theory, be doing really, really well with all the food inflation we've got. Those agricultural stocks have all tipped over into correction mode, or some of them into a bear market on an individual basis. And so it's a general market weakness right now, and we sort of have to live with it. And it's that constant then revaluation of what's my right mix of cash and bonds and stocks, and am I taking on an appropriate amount of risk, and what are my goals, and am I on track to meet my goals? And so, you know, we've been getting phone calls asking about, you know, what kind of adjustments should I make, or what do I need to do? And it obviously is different for different people. Life stages are different. So it's a good time to just keep evaluating where you're at and seeing if there's any changes you need to make. But that was a lot of background there to try to explain the here and now of what we're seeing in the market and why we're seeing it. The why is often very hard to understand.
It is indeed. This is an interesting times that we live in. No question about that.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. So it's 9 or 10:27 here. We are speaking with Eric Connor from Connor Wealth Management here at WLVL 1340 AM, 105.3 FM, and streaming live at WLVL.com. And speaking of WLVL.com, if you miss any of the programs that we've had with Mr. Connor, you can just go to the podcast button on there and review all the shows that we've had. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns that you would like to address with Mr. Connor, you can feel free to give us a call at 433-1433. That's 433-1433. So we were talking a little bit before this show, and we were talking about the mortgage debt and how, you know, everybody's going to say, oh my gosh, they're not going to buy houses. But as you had pointed out, it looks like 62% of homeowners have mortgages. That means the rest of them don't.
Yeah, it's a huge talking point that comes up right now is this idea of – and mortgage rates, let me just say, mortgage rates have moved higher faster than I would have anticipated. I thought the setup we had within the year is that we'd get above 5% by later in the year. The traditional standard is that you take the 10-year rate and add a couple the 10-year bond rate from the government, add a couple percentage points, that gets you your mortgage rate. Well, mortgage rates are basically at 6%, and the 10 years, I think today around 3.25. I could be off to smidge on that, might be 3.3. So it's mortgage rates are a little higher. But, yeah, our point in talking before the show was – you've got 38% of homeowners that have no mortgage whatsoever. So, you know, rates going higher, or their home going up a little in value or down a little bit in value, 38% of people, it doesn't affect them in the least. They're just in there paying their property taxes and their utility bills, and right, and that's their only concern. But the interesting piece of information in the for the people that are holding a mortgage, the 62% of homeowners that do have a mortgage, half of them have a mortgage rate below 4%. And that would then tell you that you've got mathematically, right? You're basically sitting there at two-thirds of the country at no mortgage debt or at a mortgage rate of 4% or less. And that's manageable from an interest rate perspective. That's all very, very manageable. I would sort of cynically wonder about the other half of the people where rates have been so low for so long. I would sort of wonder why they have a higher interest rate, because that data point does not take into account people that just got a mortgage that's now at 5 or 5.25. I mean, that information isn't in the system fast enough. So you do sort of wonder where you've got a chunk of population where their credit score hasn't been good enough to take advantage of those lower rates, or maybe they were so very much not paying attention that they just never refinanced to a lower rate, which would be really unfortunate at this point because it was a glorious opportunity for a couple of years where they could have refied into a much more beneficial rate to them. It would have saved them money, or they could have shortened the term on their mortgage, you know, going from even a 15-year time. Maybe they originally had a 30, and they're sitting there at 20 or 15 years. They could have even refinanced into a 10-year to pay it off even faster. That would have all been good decisions at that point. So, you know, we get talking to clients, and we hear it on experts and occasional advertisements, this idea of worrying about the housing market again because of what we went through in 08, which the whole crisis within 08 was very much precipitated by an overheated housing market. I would venture the statement here, and I think I've probably said it in the past, like, I do not think we're going to work our way into a housing problem this time. It's just not the setup. You certainly have some people that have overpaid for their home.
Oh, yeah.
Nationwide or locally. But so many of those purchases, again, nationwide, have actually been cash purchases. They bought that overpriced home and they paid cash for it. It doesn't affect the rest of us, right? It doesn't trickle through the market if some, I'll just speak casually, if some goofy person paid $1.5 million in California for a house that realistically is only worth half that, but they wrote a check, that doesn't impact any of us here in New York State or, you know, living in the Midwest. So I don't see the scenario where we end up in any similar situation to 08 as it relates to housing. We've had a strong price increase that was heavily related to lower interest rates and the pandemic short supply, if you could sort of use that phrase. There haven't been a lot of houses on the market. That's why housing prices have been pretty strong. I don't think any of that creates a setup where we end up with a real housing fiasco that looks anything like 2008. Maybe we get some pricing weakness. Maybe we have some homes that ultimately someone bought, you know, let's say 6 months ago or 9 months ago. And even locally, you know, they might find out that a year from now, they're going to be like, oh, geez, if we would have just waited, we could have saved $40,000 or something like that. You don't want to find yourself in that scenario, but it does not equal a catastrophe the way 2008 was. So I think as it relates to housing, yes, keep in mind that there is a huge chunk of the population that owns their home free and clear. And so the day-to-day fluctuations that happen on mortgage rates or in home values doesn't impact those people. And again, with that data point we have at 38%, I think even within the last decade, that number has been pretty consistent, somewhere around that 40% number. Okay. of being free and clear owned home. So I think we're okay. I think we're okay in that area.
That's good. It seems like more people are looking for houses than are selling houses even still.
Yeah.
So that would boost for a pretty strong market there, wouldn't it?
Correct. It continues to be an area where, because there's an imbalance, you have more buyers than you actually have sellers as it relates to homes. I just don't think we're going to end up with a big, big problem. I think the most likely scenario, and I might have talked about this a show or two ago, I think the most likely scenario that we see around here becomes the idea that someone puts their home on the market, they're not going to get 20 bidders like they were getting a year ago. I think it'll probably go back to looking a little more normal, where the house goes on the market, some people go through, there's an open house, you get a few more people through the door, and then maybe after, you know, a week or two or three, you end up where you've finally gotten in two or three or four offers that you could sort of look at. I don't think it's realistic for any big length of time to have a market, a housing market, where there's such high demand that you can just basically put anything on the market and say, well, we're going to take bids for 7-day period and we're just going to pick the highest one out of that. Like it became a bidding war that we just have not been used to in this area. And I don't think we'll sustain that aspect. So I think we'll go back to, a little more normal behavior is probably the way I would say. But yeah, I think at the end of the day, you don't have enough supply. And if you don't have enough supply of homes for sale, you're going to be able to maintain a price pretty well, pretty well. Higher mortgage rates will have an impact, though. It will take certain buyers out of the market, especially as you go up the pricing scale, right? It's not as to say the obvious. It's not as expensive to buy a cheaper home, right? If a $100,000 home is the top of your budget, the difference between a $100,000 home and an $80,000 home, it's not that big an actual number. But if you had rock bottom interest rates and you were thinking big time and you were going to, you know, you were contemplating going into Spalding Lake up in Clarence, well, that $800,000 home had suddenly become a $1 million home, and it only did that because of the fact that interest rates had gone so low. So that kind of home is a lot more expensive on a 6% mortgage. So that's the kind of scenario. I mean, like, you're just not going to have some of the competition that you had. You're going to have some buyers get priced out of some of those homes because of the financing aspect of it.
Sure, 6% of a million is a lot more than 6% of 100.
That's right. That's right.
That's simple math, isn't it?
Yeah.
Very good. Wow. So that kind of covers that particular topic. How did you want to segue into the next one?
Well, I guess at the end of the day, we always are going to tackle oil and gasoline at this point because
we might as well.
It's ever present. It does seem, I pumped gas last night. I do believe it was a nickel cheaper than the last time I had filled up gas. I think that's right. At the top of the hour, the Fox News update was saying that oil was off $3 a barrel. The news of the week is that the president really is trying to put a little pressure on the refiners to get more product out there. The last utilization number I saw is that of our refining capacity, they're running at about a 90% utilization rate, which I'd say for the industry for a long time is pretty much where it usually falls. You've always got some capacity offline for repairs and upgrades and updates, and it's they go offline for periods of time when you're changing from winter blend to summer blend, and then in the reverse, you go from summer blend to winter blend. So there's always a little bit of capacity that is not online. So he was really sending them a letter, nudging them and saying, you know, the American consumer needs better pricing. Your record profits and your record profit margins are pretty noticeable at this time. One of the interesting pieces of news that came out of, I think it was Gina Raimondo, who's one of the cabinet secretaries, she was pointing out that the difference in the price per gallon compared to about 6 months ago when oil had a little spike at that moment, We're 75 cents higher on a price of gallon, even though the price of oil was comparable to 6 months before. And that change is not the oil companies, and it has nothing to do with politics. That has that does, in fact, have to do with the way the price of the refined finished product is coming out the door and then being priced at our local stations and whatnot, right? And I think we all would say we don't begrudge any of our local gas stations their money, right? They're providing it. But it is interesting to know that the price difference from approximately 6 months ago on the same barrel of oil equaled 75 cents higher per gallon that we were paying across this country. Pretty dramatic. I mean, mathematically, that's almost 20% higher, and you can't really explain it away on any one particular reason. So
no, you can't.
You know, we haven't had a hurricane in the last 6 months, right? There hasn't been an environmental causation that would have said, well, you know, a pipeline went down or a facility went down or this transportation hub was shut down for 3 weeks because of a hurricane. There's nothing that I know of that would have caused that sort of pressure in the system to create that. So I would suspect, and it's not an area that I follow day by day and week by week, but I would assume that if we dug into where the publicly traded refiners are, it would seem that their profit margins are probably at all-time highs at this point, which makes some sense because of the sheer dollar price of fuel itself. Easier to make more money at four something a gallon than when, you know, the early part of the pandemic when the economy shut down and gas went to $2 a gallon. You're obviously going to make more profit on that. Or I shouldn't say obviously, because companies can find ways to screw things up, but they in theory should make a lot more money at four something a gallon than at two something a gallon, right? So that's been an ongoing discussion point this week, this idea of a little bit of political pressure for them to find a way to get the refiners to increase their output and lower their profit margin, even if it's a little bit of elbowing them in the side to take a little hit for patriotism, you know, like just find a way to pass along a little savings. Historically, that sort of, well, it's known as jawboning, you know, just flapping your yap,
yep,
talking. It does not usually work when any politician is sort of trying to publicly coax companies into lowering their prices. It doesn't work. It doesn't really work on the food side of things. It doesn't work on the oil side of things. Presidents have tried it for 150 years,
right,
on various and various industries. It doesn't really work. So we'll see. I think ultimately what'll happen is the oil companies will find a way to get more product coming out of the ground, and by default more of it will get refined into fuel, usable fuels. And that'll eventually end up with some lower prices for us. What the Fed is doing in terms of putting pressure on interest rates, all of that demand, the attempt that they're having to lessen demand will trickle its way through the entire system. And even as it relates eventually to airline usage, you know, crude oil gets refined into things like jet fuel, gasoline, kerosene, propane. Maybe not propane. I might be screwing that part up.
Yeah, propane's gas.
That just might be the byproduct of how they crack natural gas. But the certain flavors of crude oil end up with such an interesting mix of finished products that any spot along the way where you can lessen demand will actually trickle over into other lower prices in the other spots. So even now when you sort of think of where some inflation's in the economy, people point to airline tickets and the fact that they're, I think the number I saw was 30 37% higher than a few months ago, or maybe it was a year ago. And the comment I make is, yeah, they've gone up. There's no lessening of demand. I mean, I flew to Montreal for a business trip in early May. Planes were packed going down to New York City, and then from New York City up to Montreal, they were full. And that's the sort of inflation problem that's hard to combat, right? If you've had a 35, 36, 37% increase and you've had no change in demand, how are you getting a lower price, right? Well, like, what industry would lower their price if your planes are still full?
Right.
So maybe as this all works its way through the system and the Fed keeps raising rates and eventually the consumer's ability to spend money on those airline tickets will eventually lessen, right? Like, but some of it makes sense. We had a pandemic. We had people locked up to not do those trips and do that travel. And so the fact that now we've got some of that mobility back, whether it's a family vacation or a business trip, right? I've done two business trips in 2 years. That's it. And that's an aspect where people want to go see family, or they want to do a certain sightseeing trip, vacation, whatever. It's hard for them to give that up in the moment. And so that all was a little bit of a tangent about talking about, though, the demand side that goes into the fuel business. And so until we see some additional supply come on, or we see a lessening demand, I think it's going to be a hard battle to get any real weakness on the side of oil, because we've always got the expectation of the Middle East being problematic and currently a war in Europe. And so there's a bit of a risk premium put on the price of oil right now. And I would estimate it at probably $25 a barrel.
Ooh.
You know, just the uncertainty of what you've got in Europe is probably worth that much money. Now, mentioning Europe just for a second, you know, there's a lot of discussion about Russian oil and where is it going and the usage. Well, the one data point that we've got on a talk that we can talk about, China's the number one importer of oil in the world. And I would tell you, they're probably the number one importer of Russian oil. India is probably number two, just to be fair, and they're a democracy, or at least mostly a democracy. But China is now the number two user of oil products in the world, behind the U.S. But China has almost no domestic production. So they have to import vast amounts of oil. And that's what you see a lot of their behavior around the world is about. We've talked about their importing of food products in the past. Well, it's also true in terms of energy, and they get a lot of Russian oil. So the idea that, of course, we as Americans are not looking to buy Russian oil, but the Russians are still able to sell their oil somewhere. And in this case, it's going to the number one importer of energy in the world, which is China. So
yeah, so is in political terms, is that going to fall under the enemy of my enemy is my friend?
It's a great old expression. I think in this case, it shows the fallacy of certain kinds of embargoes and blockades, right?
Mm-hmm.
Europe can try to wean itself off of Russian products, both oil and natural gas. Russia still has a market for that, right? They're gonna be able to sell it to other regimes, and in this case, China. And I did mention India. India traditionally stays neutral in world affairs about this. They have a very fine balancing act. They've got so many people, right? Their population's about the same size as China.
Mm-hmm.
They have very low capacity within their country. They have some chemical companies, but no, they don't do much in the way of domestic oil production, meaning they don't get a lot of oil out of their own land. China's in that same shape. So their neutrality tends to revolve around some of those kind of needs, right? They've got a lot of people to feed. They've got a lot of energy needs, and they're not looking to make enemies around the world. So they tend to stay kind of neutral in the different world affairs. But it shows how even if the U.S., what was our number before, that we were using 750,000 barrels a day of Russian oil. And I've talked here about it's not that anyone was going out of their way to buy Russian oil. We're shipping oil overseas all the time because our refineries can't refine it. So we import some foreign oil because that's the kind of oil that our refineries can produce. So if we stop buying that 750,000 barrels a day of Russian oil, which we've done, they just sell it to someone else. I mean, it's not like they're suddenly not bringing it out of the ground or that they're just filling up coffee cans in Siberia with their oil. They're just selling it to someone else again. And in this case, it just means that they sell even more to China and to India and to other countries like that. So, yeah, it's quite a scenario overall. And again, for us, there's not a great way to just sort of snap your fingers and solve the problem. At the end of the day, American oil companies we're the world's largest current energy producer. We are currently producing more oil per day than Saudi Arabia, which is great news, right? Overall.
Right.
Obviously our energy demands are off the charts though. Like the last number I knew was that we use 25% of the world's oil is used by Americans, and we have 5% of the world population. So our usage is just incredible. But at the end of the day, you need our oil companies to find more workers to put more rigs in the ground to get more oil out of the ground. That's where our real shortage ends up being. Even though we're producing the most we've ever produced, in the end, that's the best answer you can get is find a way for these companies to hire even more people. And that's been the shortfall that kind of started to get exacerbated within the pandemic. They weren't going hog wild before, even though production's been really good. But there is certainly a lot of slack in the system. They've got plenty of land that they could drill on. I know we've had phone calls about that before. But their shortage is really in terms of getting people to put more rigs to work into the ground.
And where do refineries come into this? We haven't built a refinery in what, since 1973?
Yeah, it's something, it might be a smidge later than that, but yeah, it's in the 70s.
Right. So,
and the only improvement we've made over the years is that the existing refineries have expanded capacity, right? They've become more productive. So there has been an increase of barrels per day, but there haven't been more refineries created. Here's the problem. Nobody wants a refinery in their backyard. They're dangerous. They're loud. They're smelly. Eventually they blow up, right? I mean, there have been,
there's always that.
Even, you know, in any 10-year period, you've probably got 3 or 4 real environmental explosion, danger, leakage, whatever's around the country. I mean, it happens pretty regularly. So, you know, we've got refineries in New Jersey, in the New Jersey area, and down in Louisiana and Texas, and that's pretty much it. The other ones that have existed have pretty much closed up shop, or they're really small and uneconomical. Like, I think there used to be one attached to one of the Pittsburgh areas or something like that. And I think that was even the one that Delta Airlines became an investor in just to try to keep their own supply of jet fuel coming their way. Yeah. I don't know what the answer is. You know, if you could magically find a place that you could build a new refinery that was not near a very inhabited area, that would be perfect. But let's face it, refineries are best built along waterfront for shipping purposes, right? Bringing in crude tankers and whatnot, or exporting it through that way. You know, if you've got beachfront property, you are not looking to have a refinery built next door. So I don't know what the best answer is there. I mean, perhaps it's actually an engineering issue of, is there a way to actually increase the existing refining capacity out of the places that are already up and running? I would have to think if you got permitted for a new refinery today, I mean, you're probably talking $5-7 billion worth of expenditures to get to get that thing up and running for the infrastructure that you need, because you're talking rail lines and water access and the pipeline access that all has to get coordinated. I mean, just billions and billions and billions of dollars that would go into that project. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the perfect answer is there, but certainly that's one of the constraints that has existed. And you see it, that's the one area that you really see every time when you do have a hurricane problem come through the Gulf. That's why the price of gas goes up during hurricanes into Louisiana or into Texas. It's the refinery shutdowns that create the increase in gas. It's not an oil problem. It's a finished product problem. Sort of like when we early last year, when we were talking about the price of lumber suddenly going up so strongly in early 2021. And, you know, I would jokingly say, well, there's no shortage of trees.
Right.
Right. It's, so in terms of a hurricane and the price of oil, it's not a shortage of oil. It's the problem in the refineries to actually take the oil and turn it into a finished product, which is gasoline. That's where the problem comes in. So, yeah, I wish there was a magic answer. We could find a way to get more refined product that also meshed better with the oil coming out of the ground. Some U.S. oil gets shipped overseas to get refined in foreign refineries because they're geared for that style of oil that comes out of the ground. There's a lot of impurities in oil, sulfur being one of the big ones. I'm not an engineer to be able to talk about the other things, so, you know, that's my nickel's worth of information that it's sulfur, probably a lot of other things to worry about as well. So we ship a lot of oil to get processed overseas, but that's why. The reason is because we don't have the refining capacity to handle that oil here, and maybe that would be one of the improvements that could be made. So, you know, trying to wrap it up a little bit as we near the end, you know, we've mentioned mortgages and oil and commodities and all of that to sort of point out that's what the market's trying to figure out day by day, and combine that with inflation and interest rates. Those are the parts that are creating sort of this news buffet. I keep trying to use some food analogies right now. because it's really, I am actually hungry.
Me too.
and it sort of shows, it helps explain a little bit of the back and forth of what the market's doing right now. So I'll give one last little snippet. The opening period of the market today, we had the Dow up and the NASDAQ up too. But as we got past the first 30 minutes or so of the market, the Dow actually turned negative. So I think it was up about 240, 250 at its high. Yeah. We're down about 100 points right now on the Dow. NASDAQ has stayed up. It's a better day in the moment. It's not up a lot, but it's a better day in the moment for some tech stocks. But they've been impacted, you know, across the board. So hopefully that helped for the listeners out there. I'll be back in a couple of weeks. We'll try to
reanalyze everything.
Yeah, try to analyze it again. Do it again in 2 weeks.
All right, folks. Well, thank you for listening. We've been talking to Eric Connor, who's the president, CEO, and mastermind of Connor Wealth Management. And, of course, he is located at 5860 Snyder Drive right here in Lockport. If you'd like to have a consultation with him, you can call 439-1143. That's 439-1143. Leave a message and he will get back with you, and you can speak with him in person about your financial needs. Eric, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Hope you have a great 2 weeks, and I look forward to seeing you again. And we'll Keep on, children.
There you go.
All right.
Happy Father's Day out there.
Ah, same to you, sir.